The Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. Members on our agenda today, we're going to ask the Department of Corrections to take, Commissioner, if you could just limit it to maybe 10 minutes today, and we have all of this reentry presentation, and we might have some time tomorrow if there's additional questions. I don't know if you can be here or Commissioner Benson tomorrow. But let's just take 10 minutes and go through some more of your slides, and that's okay.
Mr. Chair and members, you scared Harley Nelson off, so I had to bring back the next team, and this is Ken Mers, and he's the assistant in the Community Services Division. I think we were just finishing up by... we had just finished on slide 13, and the next slide was to just look at the number of sex offenders. We had talked about increasing the number of enhanced sex offender agents, and the next page just gives some statistics on sex offenders in Minnesota. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is in charge of the registry, but right now we have about 14,000 active offenders on the registry, and about one-fourth of those are still under some kind of supervision. The rest of them have completely finished up any kind of supervision, and their only requirement is to register as a sex offender. The bottom of the slide just shows how many are on supervision. There are almost 1,600 in the prison. Out in the community, 1,022 on supervised release, 3,000 adults, but a little over 3,000 adults, and 607 juveniles. The 300 are the ones that have been committed as civilly committed to the state hospital.
Excuse me, Commissioner, did you have a quick question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morning, Commissioner. One of the things for the sex offender assessment is they're asking for an initiative. The governor has the initiative to expand the list of sex offender offenses that are assessed. You're asking for $75,000 in addition to the $350,000 to bring you up to keep pace.
That right now in the base budget is $350,000 a year that goes to the counties for them to do sex offender assessments. We're asking that to be increased by $75,000 a year to take, there's some more categories of offense that the POs are required to do assessments on, so we wanted to get more reimbursement for those.
Okay, and so that's going directly to the counties for their work?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's correct. It's to reimburse the counties for the time spent on actually doing the assessments.
Okay, because, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Yeah, one last question. Sorry, I know they wanted to be brief. Because my understanding is the $350,000 is to bring you up to speed. To bring you up so that you're not over, you know, for the caseload, you're not overburdened. And now to add the additional offenses to be assessed, $75,000, that's enough?
Commissioner?
Chair, Representative, that's, we believe it is.
Okay.
Please proceed.
I'm going to listen.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ken Mers, and I'll cover the next couple of slides for you. The next one is the sentencing to service work crews. Sentencing to service is probably one of our most successful and popular programs that we run out in the community in cooperation with the counties and their local jails. Approximately 8 years ago, we had a revolving fund that had generated some revenue one-time revenue that we were able to carry forward. We were instructed by the state auditor to begin to spend that money down. And so one of the ways we chose to do that was to start some additional crews, approximately six crews in Jackson, Cottonwood, Olmsted, Fillmore, Crow Wing, Fairmont, and then a contract with Hennepin County for an additional crew. At the time, we told each of these jurisdictions that this was one-time funding, and eventually it would reach the point where we would not be able to sustain those crews any longer, and they were well aware of that. However, as I said, this is a very popular program, a very valuable program to the community, and so the governor has recommended permanent funding for these crews. It's $600,000 each year for a total of $1.2 million for the biennium. The next slide is for the short-term offender program.
Excuse me, Mr. Mears, I wonder if we can hold off on these next two slides because we're covering short-term offenders tomorrow and we're doing the reentry initiative today. So if we could do that and we could expedite.
Makes my job much easier.
To slide 18, I guess it would be.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dennis Benson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Institutions Division, and this next Governor's initiative is the compensation adjustment. We had some discussion on this yesterday, but basically it's a $30.9 million inclusion in the Governor's budget to simply keep up with inflation. It includes across-the-board increases, retirement increases. As some of you probably know, last year the state's portion of the Correctional Officer Early Retirement Program increased, and so our amount for the inflationary increase for all of our 24/7 positions is 4.25%. Those non-24/7 direct care positions like ours in central office, that's at what the rest of the state is getting, 3.25. So again, the first year it's 10.164 million, and the second year it's 20.736 million. We have a very staff-rich agency with about 82% of this funding going to the 10 correctional facilities and 11% going to community services. Again, if we did not get this appropriation, the loss to the agency would be somewhere around 600 positions just to keep up with the rate of inflation. And Mr. Chair and members, the last two slides are speak to some bonding issues that are included in the governor's emergency bonding bill, and they are asset preservation initiatives. And I discussed this briefly with many of you last Friday at the Oak Park Heights facility. They are both at the Oak Park Heights facility, and the first one is the perimeter system. We talked about that briefly. We have a 25-year-old perimeter out there. While it's one of our newest institutions, it is 25 years old. Technology has come a long, long ways in the last 25 years, and it's unfortunate, but we have medium custody institutions that have perimeters that are superior to what we have at our state-of-the-art maximum custody institution. We have real problems with respect to the outer perimeter, where we have a shaker system where we're no longer able to get parts. We have a couple of remaining modules, and after that we may have some dead zones out there. This is a critical asset preservation piece that we had hoped last year when we got our bonding our asset preservation and our bonding bill that we would have enough money to complete this upgrade, but unfortunately we were left with only $5 million in asset preservation. And for an agency with, as I always say, 10 little cities around the state, that's not a lot of money. We had we invested a lot in the boilers out at the spill water facility that we discussed briefly yesterday, and there just simply wasn't enough. We did put some dollars into the next emergency asset preservation request that I'll get to in a moment. The total request here is $3.875 million. And then the second and last asset preservation request included in the governor's budget is an appropriation of $2.242 million, and basically to finally deal with this ventilation slash mold issue that we've been struggling with for the better part of the 25 years that that facility has been open. We have tried everything from encapsulating the insulation. As I told you on Friday, these huge vents that come off of our chiller, the insulation was on the inside. That's the way they did it in the 70s. And when you blow the cool air across it, it really creates a perfect environment to grow mold. We've tried encapsulating it. We've tried removing it, and to no avail. We did invest $1.45 million out of last year's asset preservation appropriation to begin repairing this issue, but we've had some health issues out there. We've had a workers' comp issue, and again, this is a serious health issue that we really must address.
Commissioner, we have two members with questions, and then we're going to, if that's okay, if you're done, we'll go to the reentry program. So, Commissioner Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The representative is elevated you or something.
Is that a
priest? Mr. Chairman, I thought that only happened to Republicans who lost the election.
He said that, not me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and if I could just ask the department to give some further clarification on the compensation adjustment slide. I guess here's another instance where I don't get the math. If, as I read the slide, it's necessary to maintain current service level, I don't understand how in 1 year it maintains 193 FTEs and another 416 FTEs. I don't get how that is maintaining current levels, and why in one calendar year to maintain current levels you'd see an over 100% jump in requested appropriations. So here's another instance, much like yesterday, where I guess I need some further clarification on how that math is working.
Commissioner, you want to take a shot at that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Buskins, I'll give it a shot here. We have our assistant commissioner who was previously our finance director. Maybe she can help me out. But basically, the costs of the first year are capitalized into the second year, too. So it's really kind of double the money the second year. If you're giving 4.5% 1 year, the base becomes a little bit higher. So now the second year you're giving 4.5% on a higher base amount. Not only the 4.5%, but the total amount is increased. So these numbers are generated by our system, and we've drilled these down very carefully with Department of Finance, and that's just the way that the numbers end up in terms of the amounts.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and I need a better explanation than that, because I understand a little bit of math, and 4.5 on top of 4.5 does not equal 100% increase in one fiscal year. So there's something else going on. I'm not saying something nefarious. I just want to know, you know, what's going on as we look to appropriate the $30.9 million in new revenue.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, my name is Lisa Cornelius, Assistant Commissioner for Support Services for the Department of Corrections. As Deputy Commissioner Benson said, the amounts do compound. We are passing out a sheet right now which will explain to you by institution which each of the costs is for and what the increase is in the next year. This includes across-the-board increases. It includes insurance. It includes step increases in retirement. So there's several different components of this process, and hopefully the sheet we pass out will provide some more explanation.
Representative Fiskins? Okay. I think we'll have some time to review some of these budget issues that are still outstanding at later committee meetings. Representative Hillstrom, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, mine is also a budget item on page 8 of the budget, and so they maybe want to address this at a later time. But to start off with, state statute talks about the per diem calculation and what it's supposed to include. And then on page 8 of the budget book, there are per diems listed. The last time I asked this question, per diem, the way it was calculated and the way state law was written were not the same. I believe that that is still the case, and I think that this committee should talk about whether or not we would like that per diem to be following state law. The second thing is that the Department of Correction has three documents, their performance report, this budget book, and on the department website, there's the department results. And in those three documents, there are two different figures for what it cost in 04 for per diem. And considering that is in the past, I would think that they should at least be the same because we know what it cost in the past.
Representative Hillstrom, tomorrow we're going to spend a bulk of half of the committee hearing on the performance standards, so maybe we can take the whole per diem question up then. Would that be okay, or do you? Or
that no, that would be fine. I don't need to have an answer now. That would be great. And then just one last thing, Mr. Chair, that they should be prepared for is they have target numbers, budget target numbers, in the budget book and in their performance report and other reports, and it appears as if they are not making their budget targets, and it would be nice to know how come.
So, Commissioner Fabian, could you be here or someone be here tomorrow to address that? Okay. Members, we have a quorum present. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes of January 25th and January 30th? Representative Bigham moves the approval of the minutes of January 25th and 30th. Are there any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
That motion prevails. Now we will move into the, sorry for rushing today, but I really want to, we have some speakers from other programs that wanted to come and address us on reentry efforts. But first we'll have the DOC, Mr. Johnson, who is the Director of Reentry Services. Representative Mullery has already had a committee hearing on some reentry efforts, and you spoke to that committee, so some members here have heard your testimony. But we would like you to take about 10 minutes and talk about what DOC is currently doing relative to reentry. And then we'll hear from some other organizations that would like us to hear some ideas about reentry that could help us formulate a plan here for the legislative session. I think that my reading of this committee is that there's bipartisan support to do some things differently and maybe to provide some more resources on top of what the governor has recommended for reentry efforts. So, Mr. Johnson, if you would proceed. Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In light of the fact that we're having a little trouble with our PowerPoint presentation, I'll refer you to the PowerPoint handout that you all should probably have in front of you. This presentation was originally set up to take about a half an hour, so I am going to really fly through just some of the high points and ask you to refer to that PowerPoint and to the handouts that we've given you. I'll just talk for a minute about what those handouts are. You've got this, and I think those committee members who were present at our presentation with Representative Mullery, you probably already got these things. But for those that weren't there, we just want to let you know what we're doing around some of our reentry initiatives. This particular document is a listing of the transition coalition that we facilitate on a monthly basis at our central office with the department. We bring together community agencies, service providers, to network with each other and to be brought up to speed as to what we are doing as a department around reentry and programming for our offenders. The second document I want to point out is this colored one. This is a list of those members who are part of our steering committee for MCOR. MCOR is an acronym that stands for the Minnesota Comprehensive Offender Reentry Plan. That is our statewide reentry initiative. This steering committee is made up of members of three pilot counties who are part of our process, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Olmsted counties. We've got representatives from state agencies who have business that intersects with our offenders who also sit on that committee, along with faith-based organizations and nonprofits who sit on that group. The third and last handout that I want to point out is our adult release, pre-release program handout, or handbook, I'm sorry. This is a handbook that's given to all those offenders who go through our three-day pre-release class, and that's a mandatory class in our institutions, and it's taught by staff as opposed to inmate volunteers.
Mr. Johnson, one moment, please. If you, we have copies of this, but limited numbers for, I'm not sure why, but some of you received these representative Chair Mullery's committee, so if you'd like one, the page will be coming around with them, and we have about 15 copies, I think.
Sure.
Representative Eastland?
Did we also, are we supposed to have the slide?
I don't believe that we don't have this presentation. No, I don't believe so.
We don't have the slide here.
Are we asking?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I think we have the PowerPoint back up and ready to go here. So I'll just start with the definition of reentry for you. Reentry is the process of transition that offenders make from confinement to the community. This is a definition that came out of the Reentry Policy Council, a national organization that took a look at best practices for reentry. And this is the organization that we are modeling our reentry initiative on. The important thing to know about this is that reentry is a continuum. It starts early on in the institution. It carries through the process of whatever programming an offender goes through in the institution. And then upon his release, reentry principles are things that we want to implement with those agents that supervise our offenders, and theoretically and ideally what we hope to do is have a case plan that an offender could keep with him or her and be able to use if after we're through with our supervision of that offender, they can maybe get some programming from other state agencies who understand what that case plan is. The next slide is the reentry focus. Again, reentry initiatives are good public policy, public safety policy. Some of the areas that that we need to pay special attention to is employment for offenders, housing for offenders, health needs, both behavioral and physical health needs, and reintegration of those offenders with their families and back into their communities. The next slide has to do with the fact that we in Minnesota have a long history of doing reentry programming. We have never given up on the process of programming for our offenders. And I could go into a long litany about some of the programs that we provide for our offenders, but I don't think time is going to allow that today.
Mr. Johnson, one moment, please. Representative Cornish, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, sir, the driver's license and transportation, is that part of employment, or how big of an item is that in reentry? Do you help them with the DL, and a lot of them, I imagine, don't have one or is expired?
Mr. Johnson?
Chairman and Representative Cornish, we do have ID documentation programming at our institutions. We try to ensure that each offender who is about to be released has the kinds of identification and documents that are required for them to get a job and be able to identify who they are. So, yes, we do that. We've got a number of community partnerships that we're very proud of in the state of Minnesota, and we've got a long history of trying to foster that kind of programming in our communities. There's a laundry list here of things that we do as programming in our institutions, and I'm going to really jump past this at this point because time isn't going to allow us to do that. The next slide is one that we put together about fast facts, data, information, numbers here about our programming that we do in our institutions. And again, because of the time constraints, I would hope if you have any questions about some of those statistics, we'd have a chance to respond to you about that and give you some clarification about it.
Suffice Mr. Johnson, could you make a copy of this so we can actually have it? Oh, you've got it already. Okay. If you just give it to the page, we can. Please continue.
Okay. Actually, we have a couple of slides here that give some facts about our offenders in our program. A couple of important ones, I guess, is that 85% of those offenders that enter our institutions are diagnosed as either chemically dependent or chemically abused. It's a big issue in terms of reentry for our offenders. And we attempt to provide programming for those people, treatment programming in all of our institutions. We aren't able to actually treat everyone that comes in. 85% of those offenders that enter our institution is a number in the thousands. And because of the limits to the sentences that these people serve and the waiting list for programming that we have, we don't reach all of those people. And hopefully with our reentry initiative, we'll do a better job of providing the kinds of services that these offenders need once they're released. And we'll focus on giving that kind of programming to them when they get out into the community, if we haven't already dealt with them in the institution. The next slide has to do with the programming that we have in our facilities. Again, this could take me 20 minutes just to go over all of this. I'll just tell you that at our intake institutions, we do orientation of new offenders, and we do assessments of those offenders. At St. Cloud, we've been in discussions over the last several months about changing some of the procedures that we use to do assessments. What we want to do is align these assessments with best practices and evidence-based assessment tools, and then from those assessments develop a case plan, and that case plan will follow the offender and involve the offender in developing that case plan throughout their programming stay in our institution, and will carry forward with that offender once he's released and under supervision in the community. That case plan is vital, I think, to us all understanding exactly what the issues are for each individual offender and developing a seamless kind of reentry process with each of those people as they're released from the facility.
Mr. Johnson, one moment, please. Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I heard you say that you are working within communities. What do you have in place that works with the vast community that are growing, that are in the minority? What kind of outreach are you working with?
Well,
Johnson.
Chairman and Representative, we hope to be developing some culturally specific programming in the community. There are those kinds of programs. They're delivered at the local county level in most instances. We've got two delivery systems for supervision and programming in the state for adult offenders. One is through our own Department of Corrections supervision staff, and we also have Community Corrections Act counties that provide their own corrections programming. And in the larger metropolitan areas, it's the Community Corrections Act programs that provide those kinds of services. And we certainly could get you more information as to what culturally specific programs we do.
I appreciate that. One follow-up, Mr. Chair. So you're saying that there's nothing in place right this moment?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that I don't have that information in front of me, Representative, and instead of expounding on something that I don't have complete information on, I'd sooner get that information to you and have it be accurate.
Thank you.
Representative Mullery, and then Mr. Johnson, if you could take like 5 minutes and finish up. I know we're rushing you, and stay, because we can bring you back up, but I do want to hear from our other guests here today. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A quick question. Do you, and you're talking to Representative Dominguez about the fact that you're understanding the necessity of working with culturally different communities, especially the immigrant community, basically the immigrant community, probably the Native American also. Having worked with those agencies, especially Southeast Asian, I know that they're continually called in to do things like that, and they get no money for it, and they're very strapped on funds. Do you provide them with any money? Because it seems to me that it's absolutely necessary you work with them, but they're not getting any money. Are you going to provide for that?
Chairman, Representative Mullery, our initiative, our future plans here are to provide additional monies to local governments and agencies to be able to provide those kinds of services. Again, I don't have that information in front of me at this point, and it would be difficult for me to answer that question, but we'll try to do that for you. All right, I think I want to jump ahead on a couple of slides. I'll just touch on the fact that we have the MNCOR program in our institutions, which is a self-sufficient company within the Department of Corrections that provides real-life kind of work experiences for our offenders. And we've got a project called Employ that is connected with our MNCOR industry, which actually is tracking offenders as they go out into the community and find work, and we help those offenders focus on getting those job skills in real time and also finding employment. Let me jump ahead here on a couple of slides. We talked about the pre-release programming that we do, and I showed you the handbook that we have. I'd refer you to that in the interest of time, because I could go into a whole lot of things that we do here. Suffice it to say we have that release class that we give. We have transition resource centers that are located in our education departments in our release institutions. We do transition fairs where we bring in community service providers into the institution so that they can actually sit and talk with offenders, and offenders can look at the kinds of programs that are offered in the communities that they're returning to. We do employment seminars, mock job interviews. We have volunteer employers that come in and actually do an interview with an offender and give them some practice at that particular exercise so that they advance their skills in finding work. The next slide has to do with community supervision. I touched on that a little bit here about the two delivery systems, the fact that we're trying to develop now consistent case plans that follow offenders throughout their entire correctional stay and beyond. And we have a legislatively funded housing program. And that housing program is developed in several different models. We have scattered site housing in 17 counties around the state. We have more money that we put into our halfway house contract so that we have additional beds there. And we have rental assistance programs for both male and female offenders. So we're trying to provide for a very critical need for offenders when it comes to housing. And about 1 in 8 offenders that leave our facilities are homeless. So it's a very serious issue for us, and one we need to address. The next slide has to do with employment, and I'll quickly just tell you that we have a couple of programs that we are really pretty proud of. One is that Employ program with MNCOR, and the other is the on-track printing program that we have, which is an exceedingly successful program that develops printers for job opportunities out in the community.
We're going to have to wrap up here because we're really running out of time. And Representative Eastland, I'm going to give you one question here.
I was just going back to the 1 in 8 that were homeless. What do we know about that group? I mean, do they have other more other issues as well? I mean, how many are chemically dependent? How many have no supports outside the system? I mean, what do we know about that 1/8? That's part of the question. And the other question is, what does that mean in real terms? How many people, how many bodies is that each year?
Okay, Chairman and Representative, I would have to do some quick math for you to tell you just exactly how many people that is, but it is a serious issue, and you are right about the fact that these offenders have other complications in their lives. Many of them have mental health issues. We have 25% of our offenders diagnosed as having mental health problems when they come into our institutions, and many of the homeless people are the same kind of people you see who have those mental health issues, and oftentimes that's coupled with chemical dependency as an additional problem.
Mr. Johnson, thank you very much for your presentation. If you could just hang with us, and if we get through the presentations on time, we can come back to you. And I know some members had additional questions, and we'll get to those. But I really want to be respectful of the people who've come here this morning, other people who've come here this morning, and would ask if Marcus Pope is here from the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community. Mr. Pope, if you could come up, Mr. Johnson, hang in the audience, and we'll call you back.
I've broken a nice sweat.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hodge, may I make a comment during the transition?
Sure.
In Stearns County and St. Cloud, we have a couple of faith initiatives that actually work with homeless criminals and criminals that do not have jobs. And these are faith initiatives. They're receiving very little government support. And there isn't a lot of ways to raise dollars. I mean, a push for homeless criminals just doesn't work very well. And so some government support for that may be very beneficial. If they're out on the street and they don't have a job, their chances of going back, I think, is almost 100%. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Haas. Mr. Pope, as you get connected up there, well, you only have 10 minutes, and I'm going to hold you to that, unfortunately. We have your presentation here on PowerPoint, so members can look at it. Hillstrom, did you want to ask your question while he's trying to, while he's getting hooked up here, or make a comment?
That would be great, Mr. Chair. I was concerned about also in the performance report done by DOC that over the last 3 years on their post-release, the 36% of felons are recidivating and 25% are reincarcerated, and then among juveniles, from 2001 to 2002, 58% were recidivating and 38% are reincarcerated. And my question to the department is, at some point can they address, you know, are they changing or growing their programs adequately to reduce these numbers? And if not, why not?
Okay, Representative Hillstrom. So Mr. Carter is keeping track of some of the issues you're raising for tomorrow's discussion. So we will.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's not working? Okay, sorry. Can you want to just walk us through this? Everyone has a copy of the slide, so except for the audience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today, I want to talk about an important issue, the intersection between prisoner reentry and domestic violence. I'm representing the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community, a research institute at the University of Minnesota, and I'm here in place of Dr. Oliver J. Williams. He had another obligation in Nebraska. My outline is as follows. Traditional response to reentry, IDVAC's national response, why consider domestic violence in reentry, domestic violence in Minnesota, IDVAC's strategy, and what we hope to achieve, our anticipated outcomes. Now, most of the research and programming on prisoner reentry has focused on the influence of unemployment, substance abuse, and inadequate housing on prisoners post-release success. Now, this is a case despite a lot of evidence that suggests that among recently released offenders, domestic violence may significantly influence recidivism and parole violation and cause strain to communities. The United States Department of Justice recognized this issue in 2003 and funded the Institute on Domestic Violence to launch the Safe Return Initiative. What we've done since 2003 is work to encourage organizations to work collaboratively and expand their approach to addressing this issue from the prison to the community. We've emphasized comprehensive and holistic strategies, which includes addressing domestic violence without minimizing the importance of other issues such as substance abuse, housing, and employment. And we pay particular attention to the African American community because when you look at women most at risk for domestic violence, their demographic profile parallels the demographic profile of men, African American men who experience the highest rates of incarceration. Now, why should we consider domestic violence? Recidivists cite conflict within their intimate relationships as a common problem, second only to substance abuse. Also, many prisoners self-report a history of violence against their intimate partners. Also, what we know from being involved in the Safe Return Initiative, collaborators in jails and programs know that many inmates violate parole and return to prison because of domestic violence. Also, a study conducted by a noted researcher by the name of Ed Dondov found that 33% of inmates admitted to physically assaulting their intimate partners during the year prior to their incarceration, and almost 10% admitting to committing 10 or more physical assaults in the previous year. Now let's look at domestic violence in Minnesota. Domestic violence victims accounted for over 25% of all victims of crime in Minnesota in 1999. That's violent crime. In 1999 also, just in the city of Minneapolis, over 18,000 domestic, the Minneapolis Police Department received over 18,000 domestic violence calls and over 519 involved weapons. 17 women and 4 children were murdered in Minnesota in 2005 as a result of domestic violence. So basically the point I'm trying to make here is if domestic violence is an issue among the general population of Minnesota, it's definitely an issue among a high-risk re-entering population, and this must be addressed. Now our strategy. Our strategy is informed by discussions with various stakeholders, locally and nationally. We've had forums and formal discussions with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. We've talked to domestic violence service providers, social service programs, representatives from the prisons and faith community. And we've conducted roundtable discussions with national parole programs, national battered women's organizations, and community-based reentry programs. And we will work on the published literature and empirical evidence on criminal recidivism, reentry, and domestic violence. And we have a DVD which I'll give to you that highlights some of the promising practices across the country that we develop. This is our strategy. We want to ensure the safety of intimate partners and their children during the offender's incarceration and post-release. We want to enrich better intervention and education programming and other programming to include issues associated with reentry. And we want to facilitate the healthy co-parenting among men reentering the community and ensure the safety of the custodial parents. And we want to facilitate the healthy termination of intimate relationships during incarceration and post-release. One thing we know is that there's a lot of threats and intimidation that occur while men are in prison, and we want to address this, as well as address the risk that women can be at risk if they try to terminate relationships, so we want to address that as well. And we want to partner with programs providing complementary reentry services, because we recognize we need to be holistic and not just focused on domestic violence. I think across the country, people have thought that if we address substance abuse, the violence will stop. If we address housing, the violence will stop. The fact is, violence will not stop unless we're intentional about addressing domestic violence among men who reenter the community. It's actually potential partners. We want to partner with community-based victim service providers, better intervention programs, and we need the support of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. We need their support and partnership. And we want to work with traditional reentry organizations that provide services. The outcome, we want to reduce the incidence of domestic violence among men reentering the community. We want to reduce occurrences of domestic violence, serious injury, and death experienced by women who are in relationship with recently released men. We want to reduce recidivism due to domestic violence, and we have an experimental design to test this out. We want to increase the effectiveness of traditional reentry strategies through employing a more holistic approach that includes domestic violence. And we want to build on the great work that has been done in Minnesota around domestic violence, and we want Minnesota to be known as a national model for addressing reentry holistically. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pope. And if we could just hold questions, if you could hang,
yep.
So members could ask questions after all of the presentations. The next that we have is Fred LaFleur, Director of Community Corrections from Hennepin County Corrections. You have 10 minutes. Mr. LaFleur, welcome back to the... Welcome back to the Capitol and the Crime Prevention Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the sake of brevity, I've given you my statement that you can read, and I won't go through that. I would just like to emphasize a couple of things. One is that I've given you a profile of
2005
of offenders who were supervised in Hennepin County on supervised release, both the intensive supervised release and traditional supervised release. We've also given you some other documentation that will relate to the other hearings, so I won't do that. What I would like to show you is about a 6.5-minute presentation on what we consider the most successful reentry program, not only in this state, but in this country. We've received a very good response nationally, and it attempts to address some of the issues and questions that have come up. And so, I will just go to the videotape.
And learn new things that would better my life in the future.
If you can give somebody the opportunity to change their life, it would be a big step to some positive people coming back.
We pass by construction sites all the time. The images are familiar. Lumber, concrete, drills, and hammers. But rarely do you see something like this. Workers who are still serving time in prison. These men and women are inmates from minimum security prisons in Minnesota and using their remaining months of incarceration the best way possible. They are learning a specialized trade that will enable them to get a job that pays well when they are released. They're getting 7 months of carpentry training at real construction sites, thanks to a program launched by Hennepin County. It's called STS, Sentencing to Service Homes.
We're building 8 homes for a local developer.
Since the STS program started in 2000, hundreds of former inmates have gone on to build new lives with a staggering success rate. About 300 participants completed the program in the first 7 years. National statistics show 60% of people released from prison will return within 3 years. But the STS Homes program has seen a recidivism rate of less than 5%.
Locking offenders up costs about $30,000 a year, and offering an opportunity that has fewer than 5% of our successes going back in a new felony is an obvious benefit to the state and to the county. Personally, I like the program because it provides opportunities that have never been offered before to Minnesota offenders.
The success of the program has a lot to do with how it is set up. It begins with the selection process. STS staff interview dozens of interested inmates, making sure they only choose those who honestly want to learn the trade and who are able to work well within a team.
The men that I have on my team, they really want to be out on the job site. They're very hungry. They want to learn. At the end of the tunnel, they see the prize, and the prize is this job. this lifestyle that they can support their family with.
At the start, the inmates get 2 days of safety training in which they learn how to properly use tools and what gear to wear to protect themselves. After that, they are placed in crews of seven and sent out to construction sites throughout the Twin Cities metro area. Each is closely supervised and guided step by step by experienced contractors. Most have no experience in construction work. Most have never held a full-time job in any field.
I'm not sure what it is, but there's a click or a hook or a connect where they buy into the program, where they start feeling better about themselves. Most of them are very, very shame-based. They start asking questions. You can just tell they feel better about themselves. What's nice about carpentry is they can actually see what they're doing, so that they built that wall for the first time ever.
In 2005, 45 students graduated from the program, with 90% landing jobs in the construction trade. Nearly all of the job placements were with union companies.
One of my best students I've ever had.
Melissa Gibson went through the program during her final months at the Shakopee Correctional Facility for Women. Upon her release in 2005, a prominent construction company hired her to become a carpenter apprentice. Besides STS, Melissa had no prior experience in construction. She worked as a dog groomer for 15 years before she was involved in a fatal car accident and sentenced to time in prison for her role in the crash.
Learning the skills that I learned through STS and have continued to develop is very confidence building and self-rewarding. I can now take things that before I would have to ask somebody to help, and I can do it myself, and that's wonderful to be able to do that. It makes you feel quite good about yourself.
Kenny Askew is an inmate at the Lino Lakes Correctional Facility, serving the last few months of a 6-year sentence on a drug charge. He's aware of how hard it is for a convicted felon to find a job after release, but is optimistic that STS will make a difference. He is learning more than just carpentry skills.
And it seems you have to get a lot of like, I work a lot of different people, and, you know, and a lot of different attitudes and stuff like that, but it's helped me out a lot, and, you know, everybody work with each other. It's a pretty good situation for me.
On all counts, it appears sentencing to service is both bold and beneficial. The program is even earning praise from developers.
And a single family, large single family is going in here.
Bill Berquist is the developer at this site in Golden Valley, where 8 new homes are going up. STS participants are doing most of the work.
Beautiful. Good job, guys.
He sees STS as an educational opportunity and says that union members are supportive as well. They, too, see it as a way to get new trained workers in the pipeline to join their ranks and boost the number of skilled laborers needed in construction right now.
It's a low-risk, no-risk way of having some employees come on that they're not on your payroll. You don't have to worry about working with comp or any of the other issues, and they're all totally supervised by quality contractors that have a lot of on-the-job training and experience. So I would say, go for it. It's really a good way to supplement your workforce.
The program has become so popular that union companies are now requesting more STS graduates than the program can provide. Plans are underway to add 2 new crews. For the STS Homes participants, anxiety about being released from prison is replaced with optimism.
The things that you can learn by participating in this STS program can not only benefit you financially, but so much personally also, because if you don't go in this career choice, you always can take these skills with you for your own personal and home use. And that's what I think is just great.
This program receives no state funding whatsoever. We've never requested state funding, and we don't plan to request state funding for this because we'd like to fund a number of other things. But in truth, I think that one of the things that we have to say about this reentry effort is that when you look at the profile that I provided you about the offenders who are under supervision 2005, you get a real sense of how difficult this task is. I mean, if you look at intensive supervised release, almost 80% of those people are unemployed, under supervision, and 2/3 of those people who are under traditional supervised release are unemployed. The issue around housing is a very difficult issue. It's not only the issue that has to do with mental health, it has to do with unlawful detainment and a number of other things that keep offenders with felony records from getting housing. And so that's an issue that I think you'll hear some of the other people who are presenting this morning will address in regards to the critical need for changes in some of our policies around housing. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Mr. Lefebvre, since you had a couple minutes left, I'll just ask you a quick question. So you've been around the criminal justice field for a long time and respected for your opinions on, and I would like to know what you think the shortcomings are, the challenges for the state of Minnesota to address the whole reentry effort. You,
thank you, Mr. Chair, for reminding me that I'm old as dirt. and you'll see it in my statement. I mean, clearly, one of the issues that we have not been able to effectively deal with is the fact that the people who go into prison have no skills. They weren't employable when they went to prison, so the expectation that somehow that's going to happen after they serve 36 or 48 months is just unrealistic. I mean, in truth, I think that we have to do a better job about how do we motivate and incent offenders to participate in programming while they're in prison if you're going to have an expectation that they're going to, you know, discharge planning without, for someone who doesn't have any skills and no future, it's a band-aid to the problem. It's bigger than that. It is, what do, and again, I'll go back. Bear with me. I'm not suggesting that we have to change sentencing practice. What I am suggesting, though, is that if you look at what we give for supervised release sentence, we have to figure out a way to incent or motivate people who are historically motivated to participate in programming that's going to make them at least marketable once they get out of prison. And that's that last third of a bifurcated sentence where we should, in fact, be more consistent that offenders are participating in skill deals. You know, those issues that have to do with treatment, while they are appropriate, even if you are treated and you have no skills, the likelihood of you repeating or recidivating are higher. And so, I mean, I think that we have to really rethink whether or not we want to direct offenders to skill-based training so that they have a marketable skill when they come out of prison. And that's the whole basis of SDS Homes program.
Quick question, Representative Hillstrom, and we're going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually a comment. I had the opportunity to go out and take a look at this program, and I would encourage members to go out and take a look. My husband happens to be a union carpenter, and you would not know the difference between these work crews and a regular construction outfit. And so they do a fantastic job, and I only hope that this program continues to grow and that we do what we can to support it.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Mr. LaFleur, if you could stay if you have time, because
we'll
have questions.
Thank you.
Next is Claudia Wasserman from the Wilder Foundation. Ms. Wasserman, you have about 10 minutes, if you could keep it to that, so we can have questions at the end for members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'd like to do today is just spend 10 minutes with you, giving you an overview of one of our programs called Job Club. It is funded by the Minnesota Department of Corrections. And before I talk about Job Club, I'd like to mention that the Job Club is really part of the continuum of services that Mr. Johnson just recently talked about. The Wilder Foundation also provides part of the pre-release classes that is part of that workbook that you have. And so we are in all of the 8 institutions in Minnesota. And so part of our role within those institutions is that as we prepare people to get out of the institution, we tell them about our job club that's located at 1600 University Avenue at Spruce Street location in St. Paul. And the idea is that they'll make that connection from prison right into the community. And literally, we do have people who show up the next day after they get out of prison with the clothes on their back and very little money to get a job. Let me tell you some of the unique features of Job Club. I've given you a handout, but let me just outline really what I think are some of the key components of Job Club. We talk about Job Club as a structured group to teach people the skills to prepare, find, and keep a job. What's unique about this Job Club is really it is for offenders only. The only people who come into this program are people who can come out of a state correctional prison. And really then our focus is teaching offenders a variety of things in relation to their criminal offense. The way we handle the job clubs is we address it like work. We open the doors at 9 o'clock and they're allowed to come in at that time and use the resources in our employment resource room. At 9:30 we shut the door. We do that intentionally because if they had a job, they would be expected to show up on time. For the first hour of our job club, we provide a very structured curriculum talking about all the things you need to do to get to work. We address things like how to retain a job, how to dress appropriately for a job, interviewing techniques, how to handle the application, those kinds of things. After the next hour, we then have an opportunity to work with some of the inmates individually and talk about what their particular needs are and help them get ready for their job search. Let me tell you some of the unique things that we address in the job club. On the application, as you can see, many people ask about the criminal record question. We prepare the offenders to talk about and to address that question. We prepare them to address the application when they ask the question, do you have a felony? In fact, what we tell them to do is not say yes or no, but say we'll discuss in the interview. We do that because we want the employer to look at the application, not necessarily know the offense at that time, but be open-minded about once the offender comes in for the interview. The other thing that we do, which I think is very important, is we help them talk about their criminal record. More and more people are asking that question, do you have a felony? And we go through a very structured format to help the offender talk about their criminal record. We call it COPE. The first thing we do is we say, comfort the employer and tell them your offense, if this is the case, is not job related. The O part of it is own it. Take responsibility for your offense. Tell them that perhaps you had a difficult time in your life and you made a very poor choice, and tell them your offense. The P is for positive. State the positive that you've done since you've committed your offense. E is then encourage the employer to hire you. And we find that if the offender has the opportunity to go through this and practice it, that they feel more comfortable talking about their offense, and the employer may be more likely to hire them. Let me tell you a little bit more about what we do in Job Club. We also help people with what we call a functional resume. A functional resume is really important for the offender population because they have very limited work history. And so we design a resume that talks about their skills. And this is very critical because oftentimes they have trouble talking about their skills. If you ask them what they do, they may say, well, I worked as a cashier at McDonald's. I did retail. I'm a clerical person. Well, what we try to do is break those skills down. If you're a clerical person, how many words do you type? What equipment can you operate? Tell us about your customer service skills. Because these are things that they need to sell to an employer. They're not going to sell the fact that they were dependable, because perhaps they were not dependable because they were sitting in prison for a number of years. Let me tell you a little bit about some statistics. I hear you like statistics. And our Wilder Research has put together some statistics about our program. Our past fiscal year, we served 302 offenders. Our average wage was $8.53 an hour. As you know, minimum wage is $6.15 an hour. 73% of the people that we work with are persons of color. Primarily 59% are African American and 77% are male. I want to just tell you a couple of minutes about a very exciting initiative that we are a part of in cooperation with Goodwill Easterseal as part of the Joyce Foundation in Chicago. We are part of what we call a transitional jobs reentry demonstration. We were picked as one of 5 demonstration sites in the Midwest, 2 of which are in Chicago, 1 of which is in Michigan, and the other in Milwaukee, to really test and obtain evidence on the effectiveness of different models designed for prisoners coming out of institutions. And this is a very rigorous research evaluation and it is done by a very rigorous evaluation team, MDRC, the Urban Institute, and the University of Michigan. And one of the unique things about this demonstration is that we're going to be testing a very rigorous evaluation using a random assignment process, which is very unusual for a criminal justice evaluation. And what we'll be looking at is testing two employment strategies. One is people who show up at our site, at our job club, and they'll be going through a random assignment process where either they can go, they will get picked to go to our job club, which will be a rapid attachment to the workforce, or they will get picked to go to Goodwill Easterseal, which is placed in a transitional job and then placed into unsubsidized employment. And the idea is to test these two strategies and to figure out which types of strategies work best for which offender population.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Wasserman. We have maybe 1 minute for a question at this point, if someone has something. Otherwise, we'll move on to the next testimony. Can you stay, Ms. Wasserman,
yes,
till the end? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now we will hear from the network. We have Steve Thomas and other presenters. And then, members, we should have about 10 minutes to ask any of the presenters questions, additional questions.
We have a point, please. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And members of the committee, we appreciate this opportunity to contribute to this discussion on prison reentry. I want to say right up front, the network is not a reentry project. But
just
we are off.
Just to introduce yourself for the record, please.
Sorry, sir. I'm Steve Thomas. I'm the CEO of the network. I'm joined this morning by our Chief Operating Officer, Marvin Smith, one of our founding board members, Dan Kane, who's president of RS Eden, and Mr. Victor Seals, who's the marketing coordinator at Summit Academy OIC.
Thank you.
Summit Academy is also one of our partners.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Please proceed.
Okay. And I apologize, we're old school, so we don't have a DVD or a PowerPoint, but I think the power of our word and our compelling message will keep you going for a little bit. As I was saying, the network's not a reentry program, but our creative, community-based, comprehensive approach, which we're going to describe here in a minute, I think offers probably the most thorough response to the reentry problem. Over a year ago, a team of Minnesota's leading healthcare, housing, workforce, and human service practitioners came together to address a common objective: achieve much better results in serving a group of at-risk men. Men with histories of incarceration, chronic unemployment, and often homelessness. A disproportionate number of these men are African American. They're chronically unemployed, socially isolated, and they're battling a host of mental health conditions and substance abuse. Most of these men are also costly and routine users of public-funded services. Our partners, which includes the African American Men Project, the Family Housing Fund, Medica, North Point Health and Wellness Center, RS Eden, Summit Academy, and Twin Cities Rise, operate well-designed, well-intentioned, and well-managed programs, but a litany of social, financial, and bureaucratic hurdles undermine their potential impact. To complicate matters, the systems and services meant to assist these men are fragmented, uncoordinated, and very expensive. The result is a costly duplication of effort, repeat interventions with poor outcomes, a narrow focus on symptoms rather than root causes, and there's a heavy reliance on institutional and short-term support. In response to these issues, our partners have crafted a shared vision and a practical strategy. We intend to promote the recovery, resiliency, and prosperity of at-risk adult men by creating communities of men who are doing well. Just as important, our endeavor is driven by the belief that these men have the potential to become somebody again. These men have inherent value and potential. They are not bad people, but they did make some bad decisions and poor choices in their lives. So we believe that by setting high expectations and providing access to the resources one needs to meet these expectations, ex-offenders who enroll in the network will be offered the opportunity to become contributing and respectful members of society. These are lofty aspirations, but I assure you our vision is grounded in real-life experience and we're building our innovation around a set of proven practices and models from around the country. And our aspirations are fueled by many success stories, like Marcus, not his real name, but who up to 2 years ago pretty much was in and out of prison and jails over a 15-year period, abused drugs, and never had a steady job. But after graduating from Summit Academy OIC, he was certified as an electrician, started earning over $60,000 a year, and began to provide meaningful support for his family. The network consists of five core components, all which will be offered in one cohesive package: safe, affordable housing, access to behavioral health care, access to primary health care, short-term employment, and re-engagement with the family and your community. We're preparing to enroll our first 50 men this spring, and we are setting up ourselves to launch a five-year demonstration effort in 2008. Let me just close my portion of the remarks with summarizing the unique and compelling value of the network. As I said earlier, our comprehensive approach is informed by research, and it builds on proven practices and models and best practices from around the country. We intend to operate on a performance-based earned income financial model, which will hold us and the men we will assist accountable for results. The network's fixed cost, which is projected to be about $12,000 a year per man for a maximum of 2 years, is an investment that is highly cost-effective alternative to the proven inefficiencies and limited effectiveness of current approaches. Our enterprise adds value to current programs by assembling providers into multidisciplinary teams, and with these teams we can achieve scale and have greater impact than any one program or provider. And we're led by accomplished leaders and proven practitioners who have a collective track record of performance and credibility. And lastly, we are transforming the way creative, results-oriented enterprises are financed and purchased by the state. Let me turn it over to Marvin Smith, who will briefly outline how we will manage and operate the network.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Chairman Pimar and members of the committee. My name is Marvin Smith, and I am the Chief Operating Officer of the network. I would like to briefly outline how we will manage and operate the network. When one examines the lifestyle and situations that these men face on a daily basis, some people are asked the question, what will it take to help these men turn their lives around? It's not an easy question to answer, and the social cost of the problem is great. But let me offer a less costly, common sense approach to an issue that stirs deep emotions in all of us, regardless of race. You see, a key distinction of our approach is anchored in a simple and often overlooked reality that for these high-risk men, a place to live and a job to go to are essential first steps on a path to recovery and self-sufficiency. We, the network, are designed to meet their most basic needs, especially as they leave institutional settings. A brother by the name of Michael recently enrolled in Twin City Rise, a job training program in the network. Michael was a promising enrollee, very gregarious, optimistic, and motivated. As time went on, Michael's coach noticed inconsistencies in his attendance and performance. Finally, Michael stopped showing up altogether. Later, the coach found out that he had been living with his girlfriend, even though they had a history of abuse and a restraining order had been filed against them. Michael was subsequently arrested, and word on the street is that how many more Michaels can we afford to lose? We at the network say enough is enough. You see, the network relies on a number of providers who over the years have demonstrated superior service to this population and view these men as assets. Once a purchaser of service identifies a prospect who meets the high-risk criteria, a network team member is notified. The team leader explains the network offer and what is required of him to gain membership into the network. If the participant accepts the network offer, he can expect safe, supportable housing with rent subsidy, short-term employment, with assistance transitioning into long-term employment. support to enroll in workforce development programs, and the ability to earn immediate cash. Because the network seeks to reduce the expense of addressing the health care needs of this population, we assist in health care and behavioral health services. In addition, all men are encouraged to re-engage with their families and their communities. For the participants of the network to gain membership, they must maintain their sobriety, honor probation requirements, refrain from committing new offenses, limit use of costly services such as emergency room admits, detox, and jail. Members are also required to support other network participants, be properly prepared for the work assignments, and attend all warm-up cool-down sessions at the end of the day. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Members of the, once again, we thank you for the opportunity to introduce you to this creative enterprise. Fundamentally, the network will be a smarter, more cost-effective way to deal with the prisoner reentry challenge, will improve the performance of existing programs, and dramatically increase the likelihood of ex-offenders becoming positive and productive force in the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Does anyone else have anything? Okay, we members, we have about 12 minutes left. We've heard from four, we've heard from DOC and four different agencies about reentry opportunities. Open it up for questions. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask...
Can you pull your microphone down? Thank
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. LaFleur if all STS programs aren't successful.
Mr. LaFleur.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the answer to that is yes, but you have to understand that the STS Homes program is uniquely different in that STS historically has been used for people on probation. STS Homes program deals with people who are in state prisons. And so every morning we have ACE crews from Minnesota prisons where we, in fact, pick up those offenders out of minimum custody, we take them to the job site, and we return them at the end of the day.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, but you're giving them, for a longer period of time, the opportunity to learn a skill. And if we gave all prisoners at some point in time, or lots of prisoners at some point in time, the opportunity to learn a skill, wouldn't we be providing re-entry training for those people?
You're absolutely correct. I mean, clearly, one of the issues is that because these offenders have had pretty much no job history, no skills, it requires a much longer time to do that. That's why we're able to do the Homes program with the Department of Corrections, in that we select these offenders who are within 12 months of release. So we have time enough to put them through a program like this. In addition to that, the jail contractors that we work with get an opportunity to see these people perform on the job. And as a result of that, we have a waiting list for hire. But it is clearly an opportunity for not only the offender, but for the community. Now, I have to tell you that we, in 2000, when we started this program, you know, it was dumb luck. I mean, we had an idea. What we didn't realize, and why we got so much support from the union, was that we found out that the average age of a German carpenter in the state was 53. And so the industry was looking for workers or carpenters. And so it was a perfect match between the industry and the building.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got a question for the network guys there. The comment that you said this is not a reentry program, it's more of a service network for men. Maybe I missed it in your presentation. How long have you existed? You know, how many men have you served to this point? And you made a comment that you're starting something in the spring with 50 men. Put it in perspective so we can understand where your program is and kind of what it's done and so forth.
Mr. Thomas?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the partners bring about 25 to 30 years of experience of working with this population. So to put it in context, part of what we've learned is that prison is part of their life. it hasn't been their whole life. As Fred LaFleur said earlier, they entered prison with histories of substance abuse, chronic unemployment. So drawing from our collective experience with housing, workforce development, substance abuse treatment, community corrections, we're saying, let's not deal with it in that parceled way. Let's collectively put all of our expertise together and deal with this in a more cohesive manner. So that's the context. We have received startup funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to test and prepare to launch this concept fully. So the 50 men I referred to is the is our initial group, which we will use to refine, set up our infrastructure. So we haven't, the seven partners that have been operating for 30, 40 years, collectively, we're just now beginning to start this spring. Is that helpful?
Mr. Keynes, you have a...
Mr. Chair, representatives, let me just explain that the partners that developed the network, as Steve said, have been around almost three decades, and in fact longer. We serve 1,200 people a day in housing, corrections, and substance abuse. Summit Academy, Twin Cities Rise, Family Housing Fund, they do as well. But this particular project, and I use the analogy that reentry is not a corrections problem. It's not a mental health problem. It's not a chemical dependency problem. It's not an employment problem. It's not a family violence problem. It's not a family reunification problem. It's all of the above. And what we've done is we have a tendency, like we serve people either through corrections or chemical dependency. To have them access mental health services requires that they navigate a system that they are ill-equipped to navigate. They have chaotic lifestyles. It's a chaotic system. To have them access housing, same problem. To have them access employment, same problem. This is a comprehensive attempt to bring together those service providers that provide the services most often needed for people who are trying to reintegrate into the community and provide them in a comprehensive manner so that the navigation is the responsibility of the system, in this case the network, and not on the individual, as I said, who is ill-equipped to deal with it. The other thing that I would add to what Steve says is that each network participant has put $30,000 into this to help make this work, and it's not necessarily, I mean, I think our goal here, if I can speak for the other partners, is to take the people that we are already working with and become more effective with them.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question is directed to the department. Doesn't the department have something similar to the Hennepin County housing program that you are doing in some areas?
Yep. For you.
I know.
That's what I asked. I was involved.
I know. So
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Benson.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, we do. We actually started this program, and my good friend Fred stole it from us back in 2000. But actually, it was Fred who started this program back in 19... We were funded in 97, and we started building houses in 98. I think we're up around 250 houses. The difference is our location is in greater Minnesota. That's our market. We have worked with the local CAP agencies, and it's affordable housing. So it's kind of, in addition to doing all of the things that Hennepin County is doing, teaching the transferable skills, they're housed in local county jails to the tune of about $55 a day. We pay that. We pay them a wage of a buck or two an hour. And then a family that would, in most cases, probably be unable to buy a house, they're able to get cheap financing and own a home. So in many cases, it's single moms with a couple of kids, and it puts lots back on the tax rolls in some of these small towns in greater Minnesota. And consistent with what you heard from Hennepin County, these men who participate are snapped up by local contractors as soon as their sentence is complete, and they're employed as well. So it is an excellent, excellent program, and we have worked very closely with Hennepin County. Of course, we supply the offenders, and it operates primarily out of our Lionel Lakes Correctional Facility, and the females down at Shakopee participate as well.
Representative Olin.
Just a quick follow-up comment. I knew the answer to that one before I asked, because that program's very successful up in Pennington County in my area.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to make a comment, because listening to all the testimony that we've listened to today, and a couple of things strike me. One is that, in the area of developmental disabilities, we've changed our language, and we don't talk anymore about disabled people, or at least we try not to. We talk about people with disabilities. But in this area, we still talk about criminals or offenders, and it strikes me that one of the things that we might want to do is think about whether we might want to change our language to talk more often about people who have committed offenses or people who have committed crimes or people who have been in prison, to change the way that we think about people so that they're not completely described by the one worst thing they ever did. But that kind of leads me to the second point, which is that I think I mentioned the last time we met that there are really two elephants in every room that we're in, and one of them is energy issues, and the other is the changing demographics that we're facing. And I think a lot of this re-entry testimony really goes to that second point, that we have these changing demographics, and that when we think about people who are coming out of prisons, I think we also need to now recognize and be really explicit about the fact that we want to help people re-enter, not only because we're nice people and we're do-gooders, but because we as Minnesotans really need them. The same way that we need to take every child that we get and make sure they get the best opportunities, not because we're nice folks, although we think we are, but because we need them as Minnesotans, because we are an aging population, we can't afford to lose any of their talent and abilities. And it strikes me that this whole area is very much about that. That, we all know that there are some people that need to be in prison that we can never let out, that we should never let out, and we need to do a better job of distinguishing that. But those that we can let out, we need to make sure that we do whatever we can so that we can actually utilize their talents for the benefit of Minnesota and have them in employment, and because we need them in our workforce. So just wanted to make that comment.
Thank you. Representative Haas, we're running out of time here.
Just a quick comment. Sure. I've had the opportunity to work with SDS programs through my life in different in different ways. And there is the crew model seems to nurture success more than the individual going out and getting training or finding a position here as an individual. So I think there's something that happens in that team model that is very beneficial to the individuals that are taking part in it.
And members, we're at the end of our allotted time here, but I'd like to thank the people that came to testify. I think this just gave you an idea of some of the programs or agencies that are out there who can see a different path for our reentry efforts, and there are many others out there. We only invited a few, but I think that this also demonstrates the challenge that this committee has in working with the Department of Corrections to try to get our arms around this, because we don't want to be duplicating services. And I think that we all agree that if we have a coordinated effort, that we can make this work, and it's going to take more resources than I think there's in the governor's budget. But I want to do this right, and I want us to work very closely with DOC, and I think we have some great ideas out there, and I hope the committee is committed to working on this. We'll see you tomorrow. The meeting's adjourned.